Also, thank you for inviting me here. So what I would like to tell you is something about coexistence or joint measurability of observables, or, well, in general, some forms of measurements. So to do so, I would first like to introduce you to these generalized measurements and POEMs, which most of you know quite a lot of, so I will just go quite fast through it. And then I will come to the problem of coexistence and the joint measurability of simple qubit observables. Finally, I would tell you something about coexistence of instruments, some other form of measurements. Okay, so please feel free whenever you need to ask any questions. I can answer it anytime. Okay. So for the motivation, usually what we know from quantum mechanics is that not every pair of observables is jointly measurable, so that it can give us right probability distributions measuring, for, let's say, position and then momentum. Other good example is are the spin components. We can't measure all three components of a spin at once because the measurement of one spin component changes the outcomes of the measure if you would measure the components, the other components. So this seems to be quite quite interesting thing to think about joint measurability. What observables are such that if we have observable A and if we have observable B, we can then measure them together in one experiment that would tell us that, yeah, it was the result plus, plus, or minus, plus, and so on. Also, we can look at the problem as in the following way, that the spin components aren't measurable, to jointly measurable. However, we can think of an imprecisions in the measurements, and these imprecisions are such that the imprecise or noisy measurements are then jointly measurable. Yeah.
Are you, when you define joint measurability here, are you saying that the one apparatus that simulates the two you're trying to jointly measure, it should simulate just the statistics of those measurements, or also the final state that those measurements would generate?
A final state, like, these are just, this will be
just,
this will be, I will explain it later.
Okay,
so for now, just POEMs, so statistics. Okay. Another interesting thing is that we can, that is what I was saying before, that we may consider subsequent measurements and what we can get from these measurements. And also the theory of joint measurability can tell us these points. Also, there are other aspects that we can consider here. From the paper of Wolf, we can find out that every pair of two outcome observable that is not jointly measurable enables violation of Bell inequality, of some Bell inequality. So this has also some other consequences to security of BB84 protocols, or there would be possibility of superluminal communication if this wouldn't be true. And finally, what we can think of here is that such research in joint measurability, well, we can think of it that we have some observables that are not jointly measurable. What is the closest approximation that makes them jointly measurable? So
if the Bell inequalities would be violated and something else, then it would imply superluminal.
Yeah, this is the if Bell inequalities would
but we
be.
We know that just the, at least I thought, the mere violation of the Bell inequalities doesn't imply superluminal communication.
Okay,
so
but if.
But is this something.
No, if there would be such effects that would. If there would be such effects within the protocol of BB84 that would be coexistent, which they aren't, then it would be, it would mean that. So It just says that, yeah, okay, but usually you know that...
I don't know what protocol you'd be aiming for.
So you're saying if you can measure Z-spin and X-spin simultaneously,
yeah,
and you can violate a bound inequality, then you can exploit those two things to achieve superminimal signal.
Okay, so this was just for the motivation. This is quite an interesting topic. Okay. So now I will come to something what we consider in quantum mechanics to be standard observables, or usually we know these are self-adjoint operators. What we may think of them, I will talk only in the finite dimensions because just for simplicity. And these observables can be decomposed into this form, which tells us that we have some orthogonal base that defines this projectors PJ. So, and also we've, the operator is defined by these lambda eigenvalues, of course. These eigenvalues, what I would say is that they are just a scale, nothing more. It's like if we take a different observable that has the same decomposition into same base but different lambdas, it might tell us the same, it might be the same measurement but with a different scale. Like here, we can measure with the same measurement apparatus miles per hour or kilometers per hour. So in this way, if we just lose these eigenvalues, we come up with a notion of projector valued measures, which is just a set of projectors that sums up to identity, and then the probabilities in measurements are given by the standard formula. And if we want to measure the average of the operator in state rho, then we use this the scale we choose, kilometers per hour or miles per hour. So this is what I said, that projector valued measure is just a mapping from the set of all possible outcomes to the projectors. And then this means that if we have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, we can and a countable set omega of outcomes, we can just assign an index to every outcome, let's say J, and this to every outcome J, then we have a projector PJ. So then the results are obtained with these probabilities, and the necessary condition is that these projectors sum up to identity. So this tells us about the measurement, what we perform. Yes?
Why do you exponentiate omega and map this
from? Yeah, because it's not from.
I see. You think of it as the algebra.
Yeah, that's a sigma algebra. Okay. So it should be sigma algebra. Yeah.
Why did you say sigma? You're just doing a finite dimensional.
Yeah, but it's an algebra. But in finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, you usually go to sigma algebras.
In infinite, in finite,
I don't really know. But basically, what you do is you just assign to all possible outcomes some projectors.
Yeah. I'm just wondering why you made it sigma algebra.
In general case, it's needed.
Meaning, the general case being an infinite dimensional Hilbert space?
Not Hilbert space.
It doesn't have to be an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. You might just be talking about an observable with...
Infinitely many outcomes.
Would it be fair to say all you mean by that is the power set of omega?
Yeah.
So there's the events, and then this is the set of all subsets.
Basically,
is that what you mean?
Yeah.
No, but my question is, why choose omega to be an infinite set?
It can be, but it does not have to be. You can have omega to be two outcome. If the measurement is a two-outcome measurement, then omega has only two values. It's a set of
You're
two.
Imagining an infinite number of distinct possible outcomes.
Yes. You can do that.
With just a finite dimensional number space.
I think he's just making the point it's a measure space. And if it's a discrete measure space, then the set of measurable sets is just the path set. But if it's infinite, it has to be, it's not the whole path set.
Right, but here it's written 2 to the omega, which says that it's the whole power. It's any omega, not worth
it. It's a power set. Yeah. Okay, so what we have seen here is that in projector valued measures, we just assign to each possible outcome some projector. What we can do next is that from mathematics of quantum theory, we can find out that all probability measures are retrievable by considering the set of effects instead of projectors. So instead of using this mapping to projectors, we can use the mapping to effects, which are operators satisfying these inequalities. This second one means just that identity minus the operator E is positive. And then positive operator valued measures are mappings from this power set to a set of effects. And then to each outcome with index j, we assign an effect ej. Of course, also the probabilities are given by this formula, and for them to sum up to one, it is required that the sum of these effects is the identity. So this is a positive operator valued measure, and of course, previous case of projectors is also a POEM, and what we may say is that positive operator valued measures are observables with some inherent imprecisions. So what does this mean? Let's consider Stern-Gerlach experiment. We all know what happens, that we have some silver atoms going through an inhomogeneous magnetic field, and according to their spin, they go either up or down. So before going to this magnetic field, we've got them together in some bunch together, and after going through the magnetic field, the spins, the atoms having spin up, will move upwards, and the atoms having spin down will move downwards. What we may find out, what the problem might be, is that there might be an overlap of these probabilities. What we do is that if we find that the atom hit the upper half plane, then we may notice that, we say that the atom had a spin up. However, if it was the atom having spin down, and it was from this triangle, we might have assigned a wrong spin to the measurement outcome. So what does it mean is that what we perform is an indirect measurement of spin. We can show it like having some additional pointer system, which is the spatial position of the atom, and we change this position according to the spin state of the atom.
Why are you calling it an indirect measurement? What would be a direct measurement?
The direct measurement would be we would project to some operators here. We would make projective measurements on this system.
But if you're actually talking about physical measurement,
yes. So, well, this is what is done in Stern-Gerlach experiment. Yeah. So the initial state might be, for example, this one, and usually is, that we have a random spin either up or down, with a pointer system being in state, let's say, phi, oh, this is the system. And after coupling, we get this coupled system where for spin up, we have states phi up, and for spin down, we have state phi down. Now let's see what happens. What we do is that we try to find corresponding measurement probabilities of finding spin in upper half plane and lower half plane. So we perform this kind of measurement. We project the second subsystem, which is we measure whether it is up or down. And we don't do anything to the spin system. So what happens is that for probability of finding atom in, for assigning the atom spin up state is given by this form. And for down, by this form. What we immediately see is that if this would be 1, then this term would be 0. And this would mean that we can measure the spin perfectly. These functions are quite away from each other. But if we have some imprecision, this means these red terms being non-zero, this means that we measure these small triangles. Like we project to the upper half plane, but we have a function phi down. And this is the opposite. So we see that we have some imprecisions in measurement, and we can consider now the POVM corresponding to this measurement, and this is this one. We see that if we have had system in spin up state, then the probability of measuring it in let's say up would be given by this term, and if we had spin down system, so in this function, the probability of measuring it in upper half plane would be given by this overlap. Okay, so these are this was an example of imprecise measurement of a standard Sten-Gerlach experiment. Now, for setting some notation, I will put also an example of qubit effects. Qubit effects are qubit self-adjoint operators can be parameterized by four real parameters, parameter alpha and parameter a, which is a vector. This is a sort of Bloch representation. And well, for states, it's a Bloch representation. And well, this is also a Bloch representation, right? I don't know. OK. So for E to be an effect, what we need to consider are these two equations, inequalities. And this means that if we solve it for this parameterization, we find out that the length of the vector A has to be, of course, positive, but smaller or equal to alpha. And alpha has to be smaller or equal to 2 minus A. This inequality we will use quite often, so the length of the vector has to be smaller than alpha. And now, what the imprecisions we used were, they were caused by this, in this Sten-Gerlach previous example of Sten-Gerlach experiment, these were caused by these two coefficients, by sharpness and bias. The length of the vector A is called sharpness because if we take alpha equal to 1, then the probability of measuring the state pointing in the direction of vector A is given by this formula, which is 1 plus A over 2. So if A is smaller than 1, then this probability is smaller than 1. And this means that even if we have state pointing, spin pointing in the direction of the measurement, we might not measure the corresponding outcome that we would like to. On the other hand, this coefficient alpha is called bias because if we take a complete mixture as an initial as a state that we measure, we find out that the probability of measuring the effect A is alpha half. So if alpha is smaller than 1, we got some bias because we would want to measure, let's say, E would correspond to the measurement of spin in the z direction, but we would, even in the case of complete mixture, which should give us 1/2 probability, would give us a different than 1/2 probability. So now let's get to the coexistence of effects. I defined effects before, and two effects A and B are called coexistent if there exists an observable G such that for events X and that there exist events X and Y such that A is given as a result of observable on event in event X, and B is given by the same observable but in event Y. What this means, I will show in a short while, but first, helpful is following proposition that effects A and B are coexistent if and only if there exists an observable with four outcomes, let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, such that effect A is given by sum of two effects G1 and G2, and B is given by sum of two effects G1 and G3. So let's picture it. So this means that we have two observables, A, two effects A and B, and we can construct them from a larger observable composed of four effects G1, G2, G3, G4 that sum up to identity, and A is composed of effects G1 and G2, and B is composed of effects G1 and G3. So this means that let's call this G1 effect also effect G for simplicity. And then what we see is that G has to be, of course, positive because it's an effect. Also, G2 from this previous equation, we see that G2 is equal to A minus G1. So we see that we have here G2, and this implies that G is also smaller than effect A. Similarly, G is smaller than effect B. And from the summing to identity, because this is observable, we get that I plus G is larger or equal to A plus B. Okay, these four inequalities we will shortly represent in different way. Now,
I got lost in the notation. Is G self-defined operator or is it a POVM?
POVM.
So when you say that one is smaller than another,
this G is a POVM, and G is composed.
But this G had a. This G had,
yes. Yes. Okay.
On the other slide,
okay.
You said G is
just a moment. G is an observable, so it's a POVM composed of effects. G hat.
Right. But on the next slide, can you go to the
next? Yeah, in the next slide.
When you say.
This should have hats here.
And when you say in effect, 0/2 is less than or equal to G/2.
Yes. So the G is a positive operator. Okay. G is a positive operator.
But it wasn't. It was a POVM before?
Which one I'm getting the POVM is composed of.
So this is any one of those in the PO?
This is just one of them.
This is just one of
them. The POVM G is composed of, is given by four effects, G1, G2, G3, and G4. And this is G hat. Yeah, okay, this might be.
It's G1 hat.
Yeah. So now, to an example, if we have, okay, I think I'm quite bad with time, so I'll skip this example, just stating that a simple, okay, I will talk about it later, but another simple example is a set of two commuting effects. If effects A and B commute, we can choose G1 to be AB, G2 to be A minus G1, which is A times I minus B, G3 to be B times I minus A, and G4 would be I minus A times I minus B. Then what we see is that they sum up to identity plus the commutator, which is 0. So it's very simple for commuting observables. So that's why if we have commuting observables, even if they are PVMs, then they are jointly measurable because we can construct their joint measurement. If we have, for example, if we try to measure two orthogonal spin components, they are given, let's say, coexistence. We want to state the coexistence of effects A and B, where they are the length of these vectors are given by parameters mu, by one parameter mu. And if we set mu equal to 1, then these are projective measurements, of course, because these are projectors, A and B, and we know that they cannot be jointly measurable, two projective measurements. If we set mu equal to 0, we got just A equal to B equal to half times identity, and these are, of course, trivially coexistent. So there has to be some bound, and this is given in such a way that we can consider an effect G that is given by this formula, which is here is now 1/4, and here is mu. And what we find is that this G is defines an observable in, well, if we take G, we can construct G1, G2, G3, G4, which make, for which G1 plus G2 is equal to A, G1 plus G3 is equal to B. But the conditions given before, these four conditions, give us possibilities for mu to be less or equal to 1 over square root of 2. So we see that there is some boundary. This means that these vectors have to be, or these measurements have to be somehow imprecise in order to be jointly measurable. So such obvious criteria are that if effects A and B fulfill the condition that their sum is smaller than identity, then of course they are jointly measurable, because we choose G1 equal to 0, G2 equal to A, G3 equal to B, and still we can find out G4 by I minus A minus B. Another criterion is that if effects A and B commute, they are coexistent. And then this is such a fuzzy criterion that comes out of the last example, that if effects A and B are unsharp enough, they are coexistent. So what this unsharp enough means, I will talk about now. So such a short note that an observable composed only of two non-trivial outcomes when omega is equal to minus 1 and 1 is called simple. And we can consider, for example, measurement of spin, either up or down, is a simple observable. And such observable is determined only by one effect, let's say A or A plus, because the other effect for outcome minus 1 would be identity minus A. So this is why it is called simple observable, because we need only one effect to define it. And also such thing holds that if effects A and B are coexistent, then also effects A and I minus B are coexistent, I minus A and B are coexistent, and I minus A and I minus B are coexistent. In other words, this means that if we take a simple observable, if we take two simple observables, A and B, these are jointly measurable if corresponding defining effects A and B are coexistent. Because what this means is that also not only A is coexistent with B, but A is coexistent with I minus B, I minus A is coexistent with B, and I minus A is coexistent with I minus B. So in this case, these two definitions are telling us the same when the two observables are jointly measurable. So from this point on, I will just I will don't make difference between coexistence and joint measurability. So what the task is that if we have simple qubit observables A and B that are given by these two effects, A hat and B hat, then what we want to determine is for which parameters alpha, beta, A, vectors A and B, these are jointly measurable. We can say that this is one of the simplest problems of joint measurability because we've got as small dimension of the problem as possible. And while not being trivial, another thing we can say is what I will just state is that for parameter alpha could be from range from 0 to 2, but due to the symmetry and this fact that also if A and B are coexistent, then also I minus A and B are coexistent, it falls out that all we need to consider is alpha being from interval 0 to 1, beta being from interval 0 to 1. And we also can make vector A to be parallel with axis X. And then this means that only the length of the vector is relevant. And then there are also two other parameters of B, because all we will need to consider is the plane given by vectors A and B. And the symmetry will complete the rest. So we need to consider other two parameters, B that is perpendicular with A and B that is parallel to A and B that is perpendicular to A. And now what we will do is that I will characterize all such vectors B for some given parameters alpha, A, and beta. So this will be the task of what I will do next. And now let's suppose that there exists such a joint observable, which is defined by effect G, which is in this form, given by four parameters, G, gamma and vector G. And now we have these four conditions. I will depict it on this image where we have vector A and vector B in this plane. And what happens is that, okay, nothing is visible because this should be a light green circle here. Yeah. Yes, here it is like.
Everyone move over.
Okay, imagine that there is a circle. Because the first condition, yeah, because the first condition that G is a positive operator translates into this inequality that the length of the vector is smaller than gamma. So there should be a circle with radius gamma, which we see here. Yeah. Okay, the yellow is visible. Yeah, this is another condition. G is small or equal to effect A, which means that the distance of vector G from vector A is smaller or equal to alpha minus gamma. So this defines this yellow ball. Then there is this blue circle. Okay, now it's starting to be visible, this circle. Okay, this corresponds to this another condition for B. And the fourth condition, this one, means that vector G is in smaller distance from A plus B than 2 minus alpha minus beta plus gamma. So we see that we have four balls in four corners of this this object here, and yeah, it should be in three. In general, it is in three dimensions, but I drew it only in the plane because if the point we want to find is somewhere here in out of the plane, then it is also in the plane. So all we need to consider is in plane. And what these four conditions means that they have to be fulfilled at once, and this means that there has to be a non-zero overlap of all these four balls, this red region. And if there exists such a region for some gamma, then we can take any G from this region, and this will define this joint measurement. Okay, so some simple conditions are that the length of this vector has to be smaller than the sum of radiuses of these two circles or balls, which means just this. And also the length of the vector A minus B, which is this one, has to be smaller than the sum of radiuses of these two circles, which is this equation, an inequality. Now, if we sum up these two inequalities, what we find out is that the necessary condition for being able to find a joint measurement is this one. This is a simple condition which tells us that if we have some parameter A, then the sum of two distances, the distance of B from vector A, and distance of B from vector minus A, their sum is smaller or equal to 2. And this is, of course, an ellipse. So this is a necessary condition which has to hold in order to be able to find joint measurement for A and B. Now, if alpha and beta is equal to 1, then this condition is also sufficient condition, where we will find out that gamma is equal to 1/2 and G is equal to A plus B over 2. Moreover, if we set A being perpendicular to B, then we see that A plus B is equal to A minus B has to be smaller or equal to 1. And moreover, if the length of the vector A is the same as the length of the vector B, then we find out that the length of this vector has to be smaller than 1 over square root of 2, which was the result in the example I provided before. In general, this is, of course, not a sufficient condition, because if we take alpha equal beta smaller than 1, and we take A equal B equal to 1 over square root of 2, which is on the boundary of, which is the boundary case, A plus B plus A minus B equal to 2. So in such case, of course, A and B are perpendicular. So in such case, what we find is that these two circles met in the central point, while these two circles meet in this non-central point. And these are two distinct points unless alpha is equal to beta is equal to 1. So in that case, we can't find the common point of all four balls. So now what we have found out in our research is this will be just very strange formulas, long and not easy to understand, but very simple algebraically. And I'll just define some, let's call it a sharpness, which will tell us about how sharp the measurement is. So why this is called a sharpness is because it does not depend on the basis, on the choice of the basis. It is defined for the observable, not just for an effect. And it gives us value 1 if and only if A is a non-trivial projection. And if it's lambda times identity, it gives us 0. Finally, if we take alpha to be equal to 1, then we find out that sigma A is equal to A, what I defined previously as an unsharpness. This is sharpness. Okay. Now, the theorem we found out was something quite long, and it's better to explain it on examples. The thing is, there is sharpness in these equations or in this theorem that plays a very important role. And in general, what happens is that this black ellipse, this black circle, defines the condition. Okay, what is here is that we have this is a place for we try to find all possible vectors B. So here on this axis is B parallel to A. Here on this axis is B perpendicular to A. And now B, of course, has to be smaller than beta, which is this circle. So if we take vector from within this circle, we fulfilled the necessary condition for effects A or observables A and B to be coexistent or joint measurable. However, what we find is that outside some region, this can be done so that all the vectors we choose are possible candidates for coexistence. But within some other, within this range here, that is given by some central point B0 and some width, we find out that it is restrained by something very, very strange, by this, by this here. This is the equation for the curve within this region. This, in fact, is a part of a fourth order curve, and that's why it is written in such a difficult way. However, there are some simple cases. If we take alpha and beta such that these sharpnesses are less or equal to 1, so both measurements A and B are quite unsharp, we find that we can choose effect B to be whatever. That is possible, of course. And then the measurements A and B would be jointly measurable. So this is the answer for the what does it mean that if they are unsharp enough. But in other cases,
what you just said, that if the sum of the sharpnesses is less than 1, then they're for sure jointly measurable?
Yes. So
no
both,
matter what A is and no matter what.
Yes. So they can be even orthogonal, they can be whatever. But they have to be unsharp enough. So this was, for example, the condition that alpha was equal to beta was 1. So that was the necessary condition and sufficient for that ellipse. Other example is that if we take beta equal to 1, the image is symmetrical. And if we take some other choice of parameters, like alpha equal to A, which is proportional to projection, the effect A is proportional to projection, then we get the maximal unsymmetry here. So we see that the possible choice of vectors B that correspond to coexistent measurements A and B are restrained within this region here. So this was the result we got. And the funny story is that there was another group led by Paul Busch, and also there was Heinz Jürgen Schmidt. They were trying basically the same thing, but by the means of using Minkowski space geometry to solve this problem. So this was a different approach, and we published it on archive at the same day with the same title, so that nobody would claim that he was the first. But in fact, a Chinese group, a group from China, they were the first one to publish it, to solve this problem. But they didn't publish it on archive and sent it to PRL, where it took quite a long time. And by the time they managed to publish their paper, that we had already published our papers. So I would
say
that,
the same results as you.
Yeah. I don't think I can understand the paper, because this is a four pages of very condensed mathematical symbols. So I don't know if they managed to solve it, but probably yes, because they got the same results. They can compare it to our results. But in my opinion, the paper is unreadable. OK, so I still got some 5 minutes, right? So I would tell you something about coexistence or joint measurability of instruments. So before I was talking about POVMs. These POVMs are just equipments that take a quantum state as input, and on the output they give us some classical output, like whether it is the spin was up, down, down, up. What instruments are is this picture. They not only output the classical information that we got spin up, spin down, and so on, but we got also some other states on the outcome, quantum states. They, of course, have to be changed usually. In general, they are changed. But according to these outcomes, we can split these outcomes to be states corresponding to plus outcome and states corresponding to minus outcome. So what does this mean is that first, just to state what I will be using is that operations are completely positive trace non-increasing maps. So they basically correspond to probabilistic state change. And then channels are completely positive trace preserving maps, which means that they correspond to state changes. Now, what the instrument is the mapping of the possible outcomes to the set not of effects, but of operations. So for each outcome j, we get some operation ij. If we have input state rho, after getting outcome j, which is obtained with probability pj equal to this here, the trace of the operation, and the state is changed to the state ij rho over pj, which just normalizes it to be a state. So what needs to be fulfilled is that the sum of these operations corresponding to the instrument sums up to I omega, which is a channel. It has to be a channel because some outcome occurs with probability 1, so we will measure something eventually, and this means that the state has to change to a state. So this is the same, this means that trace I omega is equal to 1. Also, every instrument uniquely determines an observable A through this condition, because probability is given in this case by trace over the operation, and in the case of observable, it's trace aj times rho. This we will depict by this superscript here. For, of course, if we take some observable A, there are many instruments corresponding to this observable. So it's only a one way. Some examples are that we can consider a trivial instrument that just measures aj and gives some state xi on the output. So it's just like a performing POVM A and then preparing a state xi, no matter what the outcome was. A more involved example is conditional state preparation, where for each outcome j, we prepare different state xij. We can consider also von Neumann instruments, projective measurements where the state after the change is given by the state it was measured, that was measured. And so von Neumann instruments are conditional state preparators, where this xij is the same as the corresponding effect that was measured. So pj, pj. Also, we can write it like this. On the other hand, von Neumann instruments are a special case of something that is called Lüders instrument that performs this state change. Of course, in such case, pj, square root of pj is equal to pj, so we obtain this result. So these are simple examples of what the instruments are. And now, what might coexistence of instrument mean is that we've got two instruments, this here and this here. For example, if we get the red outcome, we get here the state phi, operation phi. Here we get operation psi. And coexistence of instruments in this case would mean that we have a joint instrument that performs both of these. So for example, in this case, phi would be equal to I1 plus I2, and psi would be equal to I1 plus I3. So it's almost the same as it was in observables. Now, if we are dealing with simple instruments, we can observe some simple things like if observables A and B are jointly measurable, then there exist coexistent instruments IA and IB. For example, at least if nothing else, then trivial instruments always exist because these are just, no matter what we would measure, we would prepare some state psi, and this means that, of course, this is a joint instrument. On the other hand, if we have two instruments, IA and IB, and these are coexistent, then also their corresponding observables A and B are coexistent. This is also a very trivial conclusion. But there are cases when instruments IA and IB are not coexistent, yet their observables A and B are coexistent. So to study coexistence or joint measurability of instruments, it's a level up over the coexistence of observables. So it's a more difficult problem. And when you can see that when we try to find the coexistence relations for two qubit observables, it was quite difficult. And this might be even more difficult.
Have to be in the same Hilbert space as the input?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't know.
In the way you
define. Yeah. I mean, there might be some, there might be possibility to do it. I can't tell you not right now, but
I mean, your definition, I was just wondering.
Yeah. I don't know what this would lead to, what problems it would have, like, getting. But at this point, I think that you could have a different outcome states, but it might be, you might have to met some conditions, and I don't know what everything would mean, like. Because you can input some state and output a state in different Hilbert space. So probably this could be done in, and yeah, probably it could be done, but we haven't tried it.
But the new definition is the same one, is
it? Yeah, here it is considered to be the same one. And finally, such example that.
If you take the linear situation, presumably, you talk about finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, which is convex, and they both live in a larger Hilbert space.
Well, except that you admit a larger input from the space, then you need to enlarge
the output, exactly.
But also you need to enlarge this, all this field, I mean, you need more projections. Mm-hmm. I mean, you need to say what's the result of any measurement at any input state, which is now a larger place. So.
Okay, so you would need to have some way of describing it. Okay, finally, such an example of consecutive measurements where here I will use an instrument that is of Luder's type, and then here we will have a normal projective measurement. So what happens is that if we suppose that, okay, I said A is a Luder's instrument, and A is given by A plus minus effects are given by this formula, and this is a projective measurement B, which is given by this formula. This means that this is a unit vector, this b hat. And if we just solve the problem, we find out that this is the definition of Luder's instrument. So we've got two outcomes, A plus and A minus, and these operations A plus or minus are defined by the square roots of A. This is, in general, the Luder's instrument. Okay. When you just solve it and look for the measurement they jointly perform, it is given by this G here. And when we sum up this G plus 1 plus 1 plus G plus 1 minus 1, we get A plus. So it's OK. But if we sum up G plus 1 plus 1 plus G minus 1 plus 1, we should get B plus. But what we get is something like that. And what we see is that we decrease the precision of measurement in B direction by this coefficient, square root of 1 minus A squared, which corresponds exactly to the necessary and sufficient condition in this case that ellipse I was talking about. So on the length of the vectors A and of the vector B of the imprecise measurement. So we see that whatever we do, we see that the joint measurability studied from different angle gives us the same result. We cannot measure some sharp observable with unsharp observable with any unsharp observable in this case in perpendicular direction. So in conclusion, as I said, not every pair of observables is jointly measurable. Classically, we can measure, let's say, height and width of the table, but in quantum world, we cannot measure two spin components of one system precisely. We have to include some unsharpness or imprecision to that measurement, which even in the simplest case of qubit observables is quite difficult to describe and leads also to some sort of asymmetry in these conditions. And as in the case of observables, coexistence may be studied on more involved measurement models that are instruments. And in that case, if two instruments are coexistent, then of course also their corresponding observables are. And on the other hand, if two observables are coexistent, then there exist corresponding instruments that are also coexistent, but not every instrument corresponding to these two observables, every pair is jointly measurable or coexistent. Okay, so this is what I wanted to tell you, and thank you for your attention.
Questions?
You had the pull push necessary condition.
Yes.
It looked quite similar to the Kazuhon-Shumihalton abundance. Is there any connection?
I don't really know. No, I don't know.
It's just the modulus of a sum plus the modulus of a difference is the bound of two is the same.
I don't know.
Okay, you don't know. Yeah. Another question. So this sort of general subject of coexistence of observables, could it be interesting if you were thinking about the emergence of classicality? So this table, for example, seems to have approximate to the well-defined position and momentum. Has it been applied to study that kind of thing?
So you say for momentum and position.
Well, for example, maybe another example.
People try to look at all different kinds of these ways. So also there are many studies concerning the position and momentum observables. And also there are some results that if some imprecision is in place, of course, you can measure them at once. But this also, of course, fulfills the Heisenberg uncertainty relations and so on.
My interest really was when you're looking at the question of emergence of classicality, then you tend to go to I suppose, very large built spaces.
Yeah. Okay.
And so on, and you'd have particular sorts of issues to deal with. Has anyone addressed that?
I haven't seen such thing. No. I don't know. You had a question?
Would you say that the instrument is the real case? I mean, it looked to me like an actual measurement, say such a thing.
Yes.
Would it be an instrument and not just a view of the end?
Well, it's a different type of measurement. Well, what you can consider is, okay, you've got a Stern-Gerlach experiment when the atom hits the plane and the state disappears. Okay, this is a POVM, but you may consider also, in general, a state that you measure. Okay, it's spin up, you got the result, it's spin up, but the state changes and goes further. So this describes also these kinds of measurements, of course.
But if you, I mean, in one way of looking at it is if the measurement, if things like the uncertainty relation have to do with predictions and so on. So if you don't include this instrument aspect, then you're incapable of making any further predictions based on the measurement.
Well, it always falls out that you cannot do better than that. Okay, you can use this formalism. This is just a formalism, but it won't help you overcome any problems with predictions.
Well, let me ask the question. Let me just ask a technical question. Is the you would like to fully analyze the instrument coexistence in the same way that you fully analyze the measurement coexistence, but it's just a much harder problem. Is that a fair statement?
It's a different problem, yeah. It's a more difficult problem because I really don't understand what the question is. Because instruments, it's a different problem because instruments.
Let me try one more thing.
Okay.
People sometimes say that you can violate the uncertainty relations if you're only interested in talking about the past, and it's only when you talk about when you're trying to use the result of the measurement to make a prediction about the future that you can't violate it. An example is often given, like, so this may be related a little bit to Lucien's question. An example is often given of momentum and position of a particle. You know roughly where it is in any way a much longer time, and so you measure its position to an arbitrary, very high accuracy. And now, because in some, now you sort of imagine that it followed uniform motion between the two position determinations, and now you have its momentum with arbitrary precision, and its position with arbitrary precision, yep, as long as you wait long enough. But that position and momentum refer only to things in the past, but in the meantime, your second position measurement disrupted the momentum, so it's not useful for prediction.
Yeah, okay.
How would that kind of story fit in with what you just told us?
Yeah, this would consider two consecutive measurements in my opinion, because
but it's alleged in some sense to have determined.
Yeah, you can describe.
And momentum.
Yeah, instruments are just a formalism to describe the state change or the measurement. So you can do that, and
you could talk about it in terms of state discrimination. I mean, you're trying. You've got a POVM, and you want to be able to distinguish momentum eigenstates or approximate eigenstates, and also position approximate eigenstates. And that's talk about the past, not the future, what state was prepared. No, I don't know that certain relation to that. Yeah. Well.
But then, always you would get there.
So what's the answer to this story? What's wrong with the story that people are telling?
I would say that that's an instance of pre- and post-selection. So pure prediction, pure retrofiction have uncertainty relations. But pre and post selection does not.
There's also no element of testing about it. I mean, if you talk in terms of state discrimination, you can sort of prepare our system for the states and see if you have the right answer, so to speak. But this other idea, you might suppose that between the two measurements it has a certain velocity, but it doesn't actually have any testable consequences about supposition.
That's right, but it seems in some sense to be true, or at least plausible. So I was just wondering whether this kind of formalism would let you make that more quantitative or more precise.
Probably you could make some quantitative conclusions, but yeah, it might help you, I don't know.
Really. Can I ask a different question? You're talking about the case where trivial instruments can be jointly measured. Maybe if you could go to that slide. So by trivial instruments, I assume you meant the case where you prepare,
always the same state.
Okay. But now if you have two trivial measurements that prepare different states.
No, this was meant that you have this trivial instruments that prepare the same state.
Okay. So if you consider the example where you have two trivial measurements that prepare the same, that prepare different states, then the conditions for their joint measurability would be the Brun, Finkelstein, Merman compatibility conditions. So that's a condition on two quantum states which says, when can two observers use these two different quantum states to assign to the same system without contradiction?
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, is there an analog of that result for instruments, right? So if I just say, here are two instruments, and I want to know if they're compatible in the sense that two different observers could assign these two instruments to the same process.
I think we've got some I don't know if it's precisely what you want, but it's talking about conditional state preparations. That if we have two conditional state preparators, when they are coexistent or joint measurable, and there are some conditions, I can show you them later in the paper, we've got them, and it just, we proved it, I think, only for pure states. So in such case, there are some conditions coming also from the fact that it has to be an operation at the end. So they have to be. I don't remember now precisely, but I can show you later. We found out some conditions.
Any more questions?
You have the necessary sufficient condition as the main result.
Okay. This here?
Yeah. So it's kind of messy. And usually when you get like a messy answer, it's either because you were asking not quite the right question, or because you failed, or there's a simpler way of expressing it, and you just...
Yes, in these two other papers, they've got also some other conditions. Maybe they are written, these algebraic formulas are in some way more neat, but still you have to discern different cases. This stays the same, basically the same. Basically, when you look at the picture, you always have to consider if they are unsharp enough, then they are always jointly measurable. If they are not sharp enough, unsharp enough, then you've got always these two cases.
You don't think there's maybe like a better question that would lead to nicer results or something like this?
I think this is a reasonable question, like for which A and B's, how...
It feels like it's not... The quantum theory isn't giving you a nice answer somehow, so maybe a better question, you get a nicer answer out of it. Of course, it's a reasonable question you can ask it, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, but nobody, I don't think anybody has asked a question similar to this that gave him a nice answer.
Well, I could make a variant of both of Lucien's questions, which is, what is... Or at least it leads into both of those questions. What is the larger picture that leads you to studying this very particular question? Lucien gave one possibility by saying that perhaps by understanding joint measurability, the conditions of joint measurability, we might be able to get a handle on, we might be able to get some means of understanding the transition to classicality, where we normally think that we can make joint measurements. But it seems that that's not the motivation for your work.
Well,
so what's the bigger question that makes this very specific question interesting?
Okay, this is a very specific question of joint measurability of two simple observables. This question came out we tried to study the coexistence problem, coexistence problem of two effects, which is basically on the level of, okay, when two measurements are being able to be within one performed within one experiment, but the conditions are quite difficult. So we asked ourselves, okay, what's the simplest case? The simplest case is a case of simple qubit observables. And still, the answer is what you have seen. It's not something very something neat, simple. It gives you this here, even in the simplest case. So in other cases, it's still difficult. You can assess some other things, but this is stating all the states. So it is necessary and sufficient condition that tells you when two simple qubit observables are jointly measurable. Here, this here, is a very simple condition that tells you that if they are jointly measurable, they fulfill this condition. But it's not a sufficient condition in general, because this was studied before for alpha and beta equal to 1. And you may ask, okay, now a reasonable effect is also an effect that doesn't have this coefficient equal to 1. And then from this condition, you get this condition.
So maybe you get nicer results if you consider a restricted class of effects. I mean, perhaps you could consider a Lie algebra, something more than swapping the spin algebra. But maybe then you get something that would nice.
Okay, maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
So would it be fair to say that, you know, the reason you don't have a simple form for the solution is that you're trying to describe a particular geometric region, which is, you know, not a simple shape. You know, if you look at it, it's sort of like in 3D, it's like a Christmas ornament that's been cut off. It's kind of ellipsoidal, but it's got some cusps in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, once you see what that geometrical shape is, mm-hmm. it's pretty clear that there isn't going to be a simple algebraic description.
Yes. Yes. So what you mean is that you have some algebraic, some geometric thingy that you will cut out with the circle, with the ball, right? Like,
yeah, the intersection of all those regions in 3D.
Yes. But the thing is that this here is not described as a three-dimensional object. It's a fourth-order curve that you can see here. Has this red shape. It goes like this. And then you have different condition that tells you, gives you this blue condition.
So
this is from the Chinese paper.
What is the red shape? What is it describing? I'm not saying it. No. Which question is it the answer to?
Yeah, when you look at the problem here. When you try to find here the intersection, you may consider different cases, like the case when you have when you want to try to describe the boundary cases, you need to have at least two of the balls touching. So you can have three cases. The two balls are touching, and the other two balls are, the common point is within other two balls. Then you have got second condition that you've got three balls touching, and the point common point is inside somewhere in the fourth ball, and then you've got a point where the four balls touch. The case of three balls touching comes out to be a one of the previous ones. So you've got only two conditions. When two balls touch, and when three balls touch. This is four balls touch. This is where two balls touch. And this is the case when you find when all four balls touch in one single point.
Let me attempt an answer to Chris's question, which I think the question that you really started with might have been, I'm putting words in your mouth, but it might have been, what is it that makes quantum mechanics different from classical physics? And then one thing that makes it very different is the inability to do joint measurements, and so we'd like to analyze that in a general case if possible.
Well, of course,
we start with the simplest case that you could think of.
The motivation was somewhere that you that comes out of quantum mechanics, that you cannot measure two pairs of observables at once, two things at once. So.
But why is that interesting? Why is it interesting that you can't measure two observables at once?
Well, as usual, it's different from classical, okay?
Yeah, okay, that's all I was saying. So that's what in some sense what makes it interesting. And that, I want to make another comment, which is that, I mean, there's another example of something very complicated like this, which is the necessary and sufficient version of the CHSH inequality. So in other words, you're measuring spins on two spin and a half systems in some sort of entangled or partially entangled state, and you want to know what are the necessary and sufficient conditions on the probabilities, the full set of probabilities, so that they could have come from a quantum state. And again, it's a mess. No one knows even a simple closed form in any finite number of inequalities that you can write down.
This is for the quantum case.
This is for the quantum case, yeah. This is for the quantum. Yeah, this is necessary and sufficient for the quantum case. Yeah, this generalized Tillerson. So maybe the point is we are asking the wrong question. We should be looking at something closer to the fundamental microscopic physics, and that's something that's so far removed, like probabilities of outcomes of measurements.
This is about probabilities, of course,
mm-hmm.
because the joint observable gives you determines your joint distribution, and the distributions of these two different observables are in its as its marginals. So in this way, you can consider it also as a problem of a probabilities.
Yeah. Oh no, I understand. Making a comment about this whole sort of framework in which you're working. Maybe it's more like, you know, thermodynamics, trying to get a simple formula for the specific heat of some substance. And if you were to look at something more basic, then simplifying, this is a resultant of a very complicated. It's just
Point
of view
that I'm throwing at.
So just following up on what Raphael just said, I think the first point. Have you thought about whether so this clearly this contrasts quantum theory with classical theories. Recently, people have been thinking about the other sort of boundary. You know, in the case of belt of experiments, you can have stronger than quantum correlations. Could you imagine sort of theories which were more extreme than quantum theory in this sense? So things were less jointly measurable. Is that a direction that you can imagine? So in the classical case, things are more jointly measurable.
Let me rephrase it, that if there is a case that...
Is that a stronger theory than quantum theory, where things become even less jointly measurable, it becomes more difficult than in the quantum case to measure things jointly? Could you imagine studying that kind of problem?
I don't know, but...
Maybe this convex thing for
something?
Yeah.
A white framework, I guess.
I would have to think about it. No, I don't know. I can't tell you right now.
Right.
Maybe in the discussion we can talk about it.
Yeah.
I think the work by Jonathan Oppenheim and Stephanie Vayner gives a quantitative answer to that question because they relate to you.
Sorry?
No, the work.
Oh, the work.
This is recent paper trying to derive a particular amount of quantum non-locality from a couple of assumptions. You know, the fact that there's an uncertainty principle and the fact that you can steer. But the steering problem is intimately related to this problem. Because the extent to which you can get predictability about the distance system depends on how well you can jointly measure to observe those on the proximate system. And so I think, that paper will make some claims about how much less information you'd have to have about two observables in order to violate the inequalities more than quantum theory does.
I mean, this has a connection to Bell inequalities, this joint measurability, so I would expect that as you can find something that violates the Bell inequalities more than quantum mechanics also, maybe through that analogy, or I don't know how they are connected, the joint measurability and Bell inequalities precisely. So maybe this analogy can be tried, get further to find some boundary on the quantum theory, and then look for some examples of theory that it doesn't work this way.
Okay, well, let's thank Daniel again.